welcome back, everybody, to today's Brexit podcast. Joining me today is Alan Hastings, who's the spokesman for the campaigning group Fishing for Leave. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Hello, pleasure to be here.
Thanks for joining us, Alan. Alan, the Conservative Party's manifesto released last week stated that the UK will be fully responsible for the access and management of the waters where we have historically exercised sovereign control. So what's wrong with that then?
Well, superficially, it sounds good, doesn't it? But then where the devil is always with any legal document, which in some ways what a manifesto is, it's in the small print or in actually understanding the wording. And the thing that is a problem is the last four words. Now, as I say, superficially, that seems very nice. Historically exercised sovereign control. There's only one problem. Britain has only exercised sovereign control out to 12 miles. So, I mean, when you scrutinise that manifesto, although it sounds good, you think, well, why didn't they just say all UK waters or the entire UK exclusive economic zone? That would have seemed a natural choice, but they've sat down and somebody has deliberately chosen four words that don't exactly roll off the tip of the tongue. Now, historically, as I say, we only controlled out to 12 miles, and that was because when international fisheries limits were extended to 200 miles through the 1970s, and Britain recognised her own in 1976 through the Fisheries Limits Act, we were already part of the European Union. And resultantly, because of that, we had signed up to the Common Fisheries Policy, and the founding regulation of the Common Fisheries Policy, Regulation 2141/1970, states that the EU will be in control of waters subject to boundary changes by the member states. And what that effectively meant is as soon as Britain increased her boundary from 12 to 200 miles, as became the international normality, the EU just automatically took control of that new 12 to 200. So we've not actually ever exercised sovereign control over those waters, and therefore, to our mind, that deliberate choice of wording is just a avenue or an escape hatch to backslide on taking back the whole lot, especially given when they could have used a variety of other choices of words that would have come across a lot more simply.
So tell me, two-part question, tell me what Fishing for Leave stands for, and tell me in real layman's terms, what's the difference to us between having 12 miles of water off our coast and 200? What in real terms does that mean?
Well, out to 12 is what under international law is recognised as being sovereign territory. Effectively, that belongs to the nation as much as the hills or the glens. Between 12 and 200, it became a little bit different. It was, I wouldn't say a halfway house, but something a little bit softer, which was called sovereign control. And that means that although that seabed and that sea is not just as much part of the country, it means a nation has the rights to all minerals, all resources, living or not within those waters. So there's a slight technical difference there, but overall, what you can take as yours as go out to 200 miles on the midline. So that's just the same as Norway, it's the same as Iceland, it's the same as Faroe, where those nation states zealously guard that natural resource for the benefit of their own strategic national benefit for the nation, the people and communities. If we only get 12 miles back, that's really worthless. You could spit further than 12 miles out to sea. That is nothing different than what Britain currently has just now under the Common Fisheries Policy. Well, we have a little bit less. We actually only have to 6 in most areas, although we could have out to 12. 12 to 200 is the real prize, the real meat in the bones. And without that, we've not actually really progressed any differently from what the current situation is within the European Union. And really, to our mind, then that would be a total surrender, a total backslide on Brexit, and it would really squander this golden opportunity Britain now has to free itself from the disastrous common fisheries policy of equal access to a common resource, take back all our waters, take back control, as was the buzzword during the referendum, and to do the same as Norway, Iceland and Faroe, and use our resources and husband them and manage them for our own national benefit. And it just doesn't seem that the Conservatives have got the spine to do that.
So in terms of that extra distance, that extra 188 miles or around the coastline, can you quantify the riches of that for the British economy? What does that mean in terms of revenue that could be generated? Maybe it's not just fishing. I mean, obviously fish don't respect borders, so it's an argument, well, if you can just, can you not fish closer to the shoreline? I mean, this is coming from a non-fisherman's perspective. Why is it so important?
Yeah. No, I totally understand. Well, first, it's 200 miles or the midline. So obviously some people have had a good chuckle in the online where people are saying, it was Edwina Curry said it back in the 90s to one of our more senior campaigners, oh, don't be so silly, darling, 200 miles and you would be in Paris.
Yeah.
But it's out to the middle of the channel. I don't think Miss Curry quite got the geography of that. She was probably spending too much time with John Major. But no, the riches in that is colossal. What we've quantified just now is that taking back our fishing could be worth $6.3 billion to the UK economy every year, and that's just in net-to-plate value. That, once you extrapolate from there to take in welders, painters, electricians, the difference between the local shop staying open or not, whether there's a fishing industry in the town, you're looking at an industry that could be worth tens of billions across the UK economy, and tens of thousands of jobs. I mean, it's no coincidence that we went from having 22,000 fishermen to 11,000 fishermen and lost half our resources to the European Union. There's a direct correlation there. And there's no reason why the industry cannot be built back up to be the equal, if not better, than Norway and be an international leader. So although a lot of the political establishment and circuit would be quite disparaging towards fishing, it's tremendously important to rural and coastal communities, but even in a national scale, I mean, $6.3 billion is not insignificant, and that's, as I say, before you extend that into the wider economy. So it's a monstrous national benefit. On top of that, it's been a national affront, what's happened to our fishing industry. I mean, for the nation it gave us Nelson and rural Britannia, to have had our fishing grounds stripped from us, and to have the European fleet catching 60% of the fish in our waters worth billions of pounds. Again, there's not only an economic argument there, there's one for national pride, and really we had hoped that the Conservatives or any party would use fishing as a kind of totemic issue and a beacon of Brexit to say, look what a great job we've done, and the kind of flaky, ambiguous wording in the manifesto has obviously gravely concerned us.
I want to go into the details of some of that you touched on then in a little bit, but I just want to know. You said there that you'd like the fishing industry to be seen, or this issue to be seen, as a beacon for Brexit. I'm guessing you don't think it's a clear priority at the moment for the Tories. So is it a clear priority for any party, and who's supporting you?
Well, I'd say the only Labour have been non-existent in this, so we've tried to engage with them. The Conservatives say the right things, but the proof of the pudding's in the eating. UKIP are very strident in this issue. And that's about it. The SNP just now are lost between what they previously said of wanting rid of the common fisheries policy, and then as they've become more Europhile, that's drifted towards we want reform. Well, as David Cameron showed, you can't have reform in Europe. You're either in or you're out. It should be a beacon for Brexit. I think most of British people do care. You certainly detect that there is that feeling that something went wrong with fishing. People might not know the specifics, but they know fishing was taken away into a dark room and something bad happened to it. And really, as we've said to the government on numerous occasions when we've been down in meetings in London, use it as a beacon. The Germans are not going to choke. And they really run the European Union. Bosch, Siemens, BMW, Audi, Volkswagen are not going to choke on a good relationship with Britain if fishing's a red line issue for some French and Spanish fishermen that cooked the books in the first place to award themselves such a colossal share of our resources. Really, everything for fishing is on Britain's side. There's nothing to negotiate on it, which I can explain in a minute. International law is fully behind us. It's worth billions of pounds. It's not an industry that wants subsidies or handouts or any particular attention. We just give us a chance and we'll do the rest. We just need some sensible, sustainable management that actually works rather than the disaster of the common fisheries policy that forces us to discard mountains of fish unnecessarily. There's a great opportunity here, and I really, really, really hope that the political establishment, regardless of political stripe, have the guts to see it through.
So let's just say, for example, that you do get what you want and then Britain does have the opportunity to take its waters back. On the flip side of that, how are the European fishermen going to react and respond? And, I mean, it must be very difficult to police waters anyway, but will there be certain European countries that will be equally as affronted and have enjoyed perhaps reap the rewards of fishing in these waters for such a time now that would cause severe economic impact to themselves?
Well, absolutely. But at the end of the day, we're running a country, not a charity. And that's really what it comes down to. And I think that the political establishment would become so imbued with the opposite view that it's Britain's duty to support the rest of the world rather than its own people. Well, it's just tough to the European industry. At the end of the day, as you allude, they have monstrously benefited from the arrangements of the Common Fisheries Policy and equal access to a common resource. I mean, 60% of the UK's fishing fleet has been scrapped. I mean, there's pictures in Denmark, we couldn't even scrap our own boats, of hundreds and hundreds of British fishing boats lying there being torn to pieces with diggers. Now, that isn't only a boat, it's not only a national industry. That's generations of heritage and families striving to get to that. And they were just thrown in the scrap heap. So I'm very sorry, we were expendable in the way in and the European industry is expendable in the way out. It's the European Union that will have to readjust its share of the pie and its fishing opportunities and fishing fleet to reflect the loss of our rich resources. To come back to what you said earlier, you touched that fish know no boundaries. Well, that's a common misnomer and facetious argument. Fish don't know boundaries. Well, they do know boundaries. It's their own natural habitat. It's not man-made lines on a map. But international law has been clearly set up that if a fish is in your side of the line, it's yours. And if it moves across to the Norwegian or the European or the Faroese, it becomes theirs. And if it moves back and forward and back and forward 20 times a day, it changes its nationality and who can target it. What UNCLOS does clearly see the international law in fisheries is that nations should cooperate. So, of course, we quite fully expect that for conservation reasons. You work with your neighbours to agree what you believe through the best science that's available, what sustainable catch limits would be, and then it's up to thereafter for mankind to appropriate who gets what share of that pie. Now, that works quite happily just now as a system with Norway and Faroe and Iceland versus the European Union, and we don't see any reason why Britain shouldn't have her rightful place at the table either. I think the government has come out quite well in that. George Eustace and Andrea Leadsom have been quite strong in that we will take our place at the table. It's just what we do with our place after that. We obviously expect, as a British industry, that we've had 40 years of suffering and now it's our time to be quite strident and look after our national interest. Certainly the French especially, who can be more militant, will kick off. And I don't think they'll be best pleased. But really, at the end of the day, that's no different into what happened with the British distant water fleet at Iceland and at Norway. And I think a lot of people in Hull and Grimsby and Fleetwood at the time agreed that they could well understand that the Icelandics and the Norwegians want to look after their own resources for their own benefit. So no, it is going to be a change. It is going to be an upheaval. But at the end of the day, as I say, we're running a country, not a charity. And we've got to do what's right by Plymouths and Brixhams and Newlands and Peterheads and Lerwicks rather than watch a continental fleet built up in the back of our resources from the beach whilst we're tied up in the harbour.
Alan, you're clearly a passionate subject for you. Can I ask, outside of this particular role, it sounds like you could be personally invested here as well.
Yeah, no, I am. I'm a fisherman as well, and a skipper as well. I'm fifth generation, so I mean, fishing for leave is all fishermen that are in it. And really, we're just a grassroots movement where we've said enough's enough. I mean, that's why we organised the flotilla up the Thames during the referendum. It was really to take the cry for help and what's happened to us in the European Union right to the heart of the capital, and we did that, and really we've got the right result, and now we've got a great opportunity to repatriate an industry that could be worth $6.3 billion and tens of thousands of jobs, and we've really got to take that opportunity and not squander it to appease either vested interests or for political convenience to avoid being contentious to the European Union.
Yeah, you mentioned sustainability then, just jumping back to a topic that you pulled up on. Would that be the biggest ethical challenge that's faced, not to overfish the waters, the manner in which the waters are fished? And, I mean, how will that work once we have Brexit? Is there European law and policy that currently governs that, and is it adhered to as well?
Well, what happens is there's international agreements to start with. The primary base, if you like, is UNCLOS. It's called UNCLOS 3, United Nations Convention on the Law of the Seas. Everybody adheres to that. Britain signed up to it. Was it 1996 or 94? The EU 96, I think it was. Norway's a party to it. All these different parties. And that's the overall framework. And it's very much disposed, as you can imagine, when a bunch of sovereign nations sat down to devise it, that the law would very much favour the nation state. That, as I say, really puts the ball in Britain's court. What it does say, as I alluded to, is that nations where they share stocks, which is evidently most of them around the North Sea Channel, Irish Sea, is that everybody should work together. Brilliant. You do that through a forum called the North East Atlantic Fisheries Council, where Norway, Russia, Faroe, Iceland and the EU, and obviously soon to be Britain, sit down and say, right, here's the best scientific advice we've all got. This is what we believe should be the sustainable levels, and here's what we believe each of us should have. And there's swaps and horse trading goes on of, okay, I'll swap you a bit of mackerel for a bit of cod, etc., etc. Thereafter, it becomes up to the nation state to manage its share of the pie sustainably. So the EU, which obviously took control of fisheries as an exclusive competence through the Common Fisheries Policy, has done that on our behalf, where not only have we been in the raw end of the deal in terms of resources, but they've made an absolute horlicks of doing so with their policy. The EU's policy doesn't meet sustainability in any way, shape or form, and I think the discards are the biggest manifestation of that, where because of EU quotas, fishermen are having to go out to catch more to land less, as they have to try and find what they can keep or are allowed to keep, and meanwhile have to throw away all fish that don't conform to a bureaucratic quota. In terms of sustainability, as I say, Britain can then go off to the take its place in North East Atlantic Fisheries Council, take its place internationally, agree the share of resources, wherein the EU is going to have to be the one that readjusts as we take back what is rightfully ours. And then after that, we really have a fantastic opportunity here to put into place a more dynamic, a more reactive policy that actually works with the unique mixed fisheries ecology that we have around the British Isles, rather than some bureaucratic monstrosity that's imposed upon it, where instead of accepting that the environment changes and moves and you've got to react to that, the Common Fisheries Policy has very much worked as a bureaucracy where they've rigidly imposed targets and then tried to administratively mould the environment to the policy rather than make policy that works with the environment. So no, we've got a great opportunity for Britain actually to run a policy which is the envy of the world in terms of sustainability and good management.
Yeah, I mean, I guess slightly off topic for Brexit, but I was reading some stuff on it the other day, which piqued my interest, just in terms of pollution levels that get into the waters and then into the food chain via the fish. Is that something that comes across your bows at all, and is it something you have a view on?
Not so much. That's not what specifically we're on. Obviously, there are degrees of that. Not being a marine biologist who's studied that, it's hard to ascertain. I suppose it afflicts different areas more prominently. In more enclosed estuaries, obviously it's going to have a wider effect than what it's going to have out in the middle of the North Atlantic. It comes back not to be rude to the old saying, especially in pollution, that trying to ascertain what has an effect where it's trying to have a piss-only area in a swimming pool. the waters do move, but no, that's not something we're particularly engaged by, but it is something obviously that Britain can look at. What we're primarily geared towards is more responsive, more adaptive and more sustainable fisheries management that works better for the industry and for the fish stocks that we so depend on get into the future. And really, we cannot, as the government proposes with the Great Repeal Bill, replicate the Common Fisheries Policy. It would diplomatically nail our feet to the floor, as if we adopt a Common Fisheries Policy under the Great Repeal Bill, we will have effectively created a continuity of rights. There's a lot of ways you would re-acceded to it, and that would leave the EU recourse under the Vienna Convention of Treaties to claim with that continuity of rights for continued share-outs as they stand. So politically, it's not feasible to adopt a Common Fisheries Policy and then pretend that somehow, because it's British law, we can abrogate it. I mean, the EU's quite clearly said if you adopt EU regulations, you're bound by them. And then in terms of actual day-to-day management, I mean, the Common Fisheries Policy has just been an abysmal failure, even by its own admission. So, yeah, really, we've, both politically and in terms of management and environment, we've got to make a clean break. And really, the government's got to pull its socks up and bang its hands together and do that.
You gave me an idea at the top of the show just how important the fishing industry was to the UK's economy. On a micro level, if I was to walk into my local supermarket or fishmongers now, where would that fish actually have come from?
A variety of places. Some of it would be British, some of it would be from abroad. The one that's particularly galling is some of it might actually be fish that's been caught in UK waters, taken back to France or the Netherlands, processed and then sold back to us. And that's just ridiculous. Effectively, the nation, which is effectively a business, it's a family business, if you like, of all the people together, is paying twice for that fish. Not only is a large proportion of what's been caught in our waters going, as I say, to the continent, but sold back to us, you're losing it in terms of catch revenue where we should be selling it to them or keeping it to ourselves. And then you're paying for the privilege of having it back again at full retail price. I mean, it's just it's bananas in terms of looking after the nation. And you couldn't make it worse if you tried.
And in terms of the supply chain and the demand, which then, you know, I guess the question, what does it mean for the price of fish in this instance? Are we heading up? Are people eating more? Or is it struggling as an industry?
Well, I think actually with how healthy the stocks have been, primarily through a lot of the sacrifices that have been self-imposed by our industry, and part of it's also a natural cycle. I mean, this boom that's come up in stocks is despite the EU's ineptitude, not because of it. There's a wealth of fish out there. It would be encouraging in terms of marketing if Britain geared herself more towards being a fish-eating nation. Certainly with more supply, the price may well come down a bit, although I don't have a crystal ball. And certainly it's an ironic truism that Britain exports what we catch and we import what we eat. So we would certainly like to see a drive towards more domestic consumption of this fantastic seafood we've got. I mean, people go away on holiday to Italy and rant about monkfish, so they go away to Spain and think langoustine or paella is wonderful. I mean, that's all stuff that is actually caught in British waters, probably not more than 100 miles from their house.
Yeah. So, when you put it like that, it's quite
good. There's a fantastic opportunity here to do a divergence of encouraging more seafood at home. One of the things that the EU, to touch upon, is certainly pushing diplomatically is that access, in terms of access to the seas, access to the raw fish, should be linked to the marketing. And that's one thing the government is going to have to very strongly resist. But we actually take quite a positive view on that, because the EU is trying to highlight that if you don't let us catch your fish, you're not getting into our markets. Well, they've kind of actually highlighted a strength and a weakness of their own. Because first, the old truism has to apply that you've got to be able to catch it before you can sell it. It's no use Britain having favourable access to European markets if we're not allowed to catch the fish and they're doing it for us. So we're effectively allowing them to undermine a potential market share for our own industry. After that, the EU obviously says, oh, 60% or 40% of UK's catches go to Europe. Well, that's a strength for us. It shows that British fish is in demand in the continental market. And when we remove the EU fleet from our waters, it's catching 60% of our fish from our waters, their need for UK fish is actually going to increase, not decrease. So how long are European merchants, European fish processors, European consumers, hungry consumers, going to stand in solidarity with their fishermen as the EU sort of cuts off its nose to spite its face? It's just not going to happen. So really, in all facets, Brexit is a fantastic opportunity for the British fishing industry, which I say does have a wider benefit in the economy. The real only way we can screw it up now is through the government's policy and the Great Repeal Bill.
So what would you like, I guess my final question on this really is, what would you like to see happen now?
What needs to happen now? George Eustace has come out saying that, well, he said, he's come out with a testy reply of fishing for leave or shadow boxing. Well, that just shows that we've touched a nerve. He's come out quite unequivocally and said, oh, it'll be 200 miles that we'll control. Well, we only not only want control out to 200 miles of the midline, which is the UK's EEZ, we want it to be exercised for our benefit. One thing to control it, it's another thing what you do with it. So I think the Prime Minister has to come out now and clear up this mess of the manifesto of, is it 12 miles, as the manifesto suggests, or is it 200 miles, as the Minister suggests? Which is it, the Minister or the manifesto? Thereafter, what we've got to do is see through the process of Article 50, which clearly states in Article 50, Section 3, that the treaties cease to apply. Now, what that means is the EU has agreed the terms of an international treaty, that the treaties cease to apply, and therefore so too will all the EU rules and regulations, including the Common Fisheries Policy. That means we automatically get all our waters and all our resources back on exit day, right? It all comes back to us, and EU has no recourse to argue otherwise because they agreed to the end of the Common Fisheries Policy. So Britain just needs to sit back and fold their arms and must not, cannot negotiate on fisheries through the process. We should only negotiate on fisheries once we become a fully independent nation and put the onus on the EU to come to the table. Thereafter, on top of that, what we want to see is an exemption or very cleverly worded legislation within the Great Repeal Bill to exempt fisheries. Because as I said earlier, the Great Repeal Bill proposes to bring all EU legislation, which will include the Common Fisheries Policy of Equal Access to a Common Resource and the current share-outs, into UK law. And as I said, that will create a continuity of rights, which under the Vienna Convention of Treaties will allow the EU to claim that things should remain the same. And that would negate this fantastic opportunity of Article 50, where we get a clean slate. Thereafter, and we've been working with the government on it, we need to devise a new UK policy, policy that ends the cause of discards, which is quotas, and moves to a more dynamic regime, which we advocate, same as FARO, on an effort control system of hours at sea, where boats will be limited in the time at sea, and catch compositions to push them away from certain vulnerable or more valuable species, so there's not a free-for-all. So that's the things we really need, is an unequivocal commitment in fishing from the Prime Minister to clear up the manifesto, a commitment to not negotiate in fisheries and see through Article 50 and take the clean slate, to not adopt the Common Fisheries Policy with the Great Repeal Bill, to negate that clean slate, and to bring in new fit-for-purpose UK policy that will benefit all fishermen and all communities so they can be rejuvenated. And that's really the four things that we are after. And if we get all of those, we'll be delighted.
And if that does come to pass, what are our great fishery strongholds around the country? Areas in Scotland, Cornwall, can you just pick out a couple for us?
I wouldn't call the bedraggled survivor strongholds. The places that the fishing's left is Shetland. The Orkney whitefish fleet certainly was decimated. That's Orkney's move to shellfish.
Yeah.
Really, everywhere should be rebuilt or rejuvenated. I mean, we've got fish all around our shore. We're an island nation. As I say, Shetland, the northeast of Scotland and the southwest are really what's left. What we are hoping is areas like Yorkshire, Northumberland, places like Whitby, Scarborough, Shields, up the west coast of Scotland, Mallaig, Campbellton and Troon, Northern Ireland, down in the east coast, the guys round about the Thames estuary who have just been shafted, where they've been pushed right back to the shore when big Dutch electrical fishing boats fish up and down the Thames estuary. Yeah, really, all these places that were traditionally fishing, where there's maybe just enough of a nucleus left to put green shoots forth. It's what we want to see. And all these places that are synonymous with fishing in the British public's mind but have been decimated really could be built up again. And it would be a tremendous injection. I mean, we've calculated roughly that between about £600 million worth of fish annually, catch value every year in the North Sea that Britain should get back. I mean, you spread that over the 30 fishing communities down the east coast of Britain, it's £20 million a year into a town. I mean, that far exceeds any central government aid or EU funding or anything like that they could have. It would be a colossal injection to these communities, and that's before you process it to add the value up to about £80 million, and that's before you take in all the ancillary trades. So you can really turn all the coastal communities in Britain back into boom towns if we get this right.
Alan, thank you. And just very, very fine, a little bit of levity. If you were going out for dinner tonight, what fish would you have on your plate? What's your favourite? Well,
you're wanting a recommendation now from
me.
Oh, that's all. Well, some of my favourites. Monkfish is certainly one that people in Britain should look more at. Hake, actually, if you want a fish that's absolutely beautiful to eat, it's divine to eat, it's not too expensive, and there's an abundance of it out in the sea just now, it's hake.
How would you cook the hake?
Onto a bit of tin foil, in the grill with some butter and salt and pepper on top of it. Some sliced up nice cherry tomatoes round about it, and top of it, and really simple's best. Do hake like that under the grill, and it's just it's supine.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks ever so much.
There you go. I've not only sorted your politics out, but also your dinner for tonight. So it's a pleasure.
That's all for today, folks. The show's been brought to you by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Pohl, and the theme music by Kevin MacLeod. For all things Brexit podcasts, go to brexitpodcast.com, and we look forward to welcoming you to a future episode.